From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is a classic spaghetti western. The film has been fully restored and is out now on a special edition DVD. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear from two of that film's stars. First, actor Clint Eastwood. In the 1960s, he starred in several spaghetti westerns, including The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Then, actor Eli Wallach tells us what it was like to work with Sergio Leone. Wallach was nearly run over by a train during the filming of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Also, Fahrenheit 9/11, the much-anticipated Michael Moore movie, hits theaters today. David Edelstein has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. military in Iraq launched an attack on a building in Fallujah for the third time in a week today. Officials say the house was used by fighters loyal to a terrorist linked to Al-Qaeda. NPR's Emily Harris reports from Baghdad.
U.S. military officials describe each of the three bombings this week using very similar words. They say multiple sources of intelligence came in and precision weapons were used to attack. Reports from Fallujah have contested the precision of some of the attacks. The U.S. is after Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, a Jordanian U.S. official's link to Al-Qaeda. They say he is responsible for many recent attacks in Iraq. On the internet, Zarqawi's group has claimed responsibility for some. Around Iraq, three more policemen reportedly died Friday. Two were killed in a drive-by shooting, one by a roadside bomb. But Iraq's new interim government is promising to take tough measures. The defense minister warned that the time has come for a showdown. The interior minister asked all Iraqis to help provide intelligence. Emily Harris, NPR News, Baghdad.
Administration officials say President Bush may name a new CIA director soon, rather than waiting until after the November elections. They say the president has narrowed his choices to a few candidates, including Congressman Porter Goss, a Florida Republican who doesn't plan to run for re-election. Goss is currently the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Other names that are reportedly being considered are Republican Congressman Christopher Cox of California and Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage. The new director would replace George Tenet, who announced his resignation earlier this month. President Bush has arrived in Ireland this evening, where he'll attend meetings tomorrow with the European Union leaders. The main topic will be Iraq. NPR's Don Gagne reports from County Clare, Ireland.
The EU summit, being held in a centuries-old castle-turned-luxury hotel in Western Ireland, marks the start of a trip that will end Monday and Tuesday at the NATO summit in Istanbul, Turkey. Here in Ireland, the president will push for a strong European commitment in support of the new Iraqi government in advance of next week's handover of sovereignty. The leaders here will also discuss ways to reduce Iraq's huge debt, which is left over from the Saddam Hussein era. Security is extremely tight at the summit, prompting complaints from some locals about its cost and the inconvenience, as many roads have been blocked. Protests are expected both to the east, in Dublin, and in the town of Shannon, where the EU sessions are being held. Don Gagne, NPR News, in County Clare, Ireland.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 72 points to close at 10,371 in very heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 10 points. It closed at 2025. This is NPR News. Republican Party leaders in Illinois are searching for a new candidate for U.S. Senate after Jack Ryan announced his withdrawal from the race. Ryan issued a statement today blaming the media for disclosing allegations that he took his wife to sex clubs and pressured her to have sex with him in front of others. Ryan said the media have gotten out of control. Illinois GOP leaders will meet this weekend to select a new candidate. Police in Detroit have arrested a man they say shot 9 people during the city's annual fireworks celebration this week. Detroit Public Radio's Quinn Kleinfelter reports.
The early 4th of July celebration annually draws about 1 million people to downtown Detroit, but this week gunfire sprayed the crowd, wounding 9 people. Now Detroit police say they have arrested a 32-year-old man for allegedly firing the shots. Police say he will face charges of assault with intent to murder. Authorities located the man after hospitalized victims identified him from surveillance photos and amateur video taken at the scene. Conflicting accounts from bystanders say the shooting began because of an argument over either a woman or an $1,800 pair of designer sunglasses. City officials praise the quick arrest, saying the fast response may help offset what they call an inaccurate image of Detroit as a dangerous place to visit. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Many Muslim clerics in Iraq delivered sermons today that called for Iraqis to unite as the interim government prepares to take control next week. Several clerics also condemned the violence that left about 100 people dead yesterday. They said the Iraqi people should resist efforts to divide them under cover of Islam. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Sergio Leone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, one of the iconic spaghetti westerns of the 1960s, has just been released in a special DVD edition. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear an interview with Eli Wallach, one of the stars of that landmark 1966 film. He played Tuco, the ugly referred to in the title. But first, we have an interview Terry conducted with Clint Eastwood and Eastwood's biographer, Time film critic Richard Schickel. Schickel also provides the audio commentary for the new DVD release. Clint Eastwood became a TV star as Rowdy Yates on Rawhide, but left that series in midstream to go overseas and make movies with Italian film director Sergio Leone. Eastwood's stoic and vengeful character, who appeared in several films, was dubbed the Man with No Name, but it made Eastwood not just a star, but an icon. When Terry spoke with Eastwood in 1997, she spoke fondly about the series Rawhide, but didn't expect Eastwood to do the same.
Actually, I liked the role. It was we just used to sit around the set and use self-demeaning kind of humor as a way of keeping our sanity out there doing a series week in, week out. And I think that Eric Fleming used to call himself Mr. Failure instead of Mr. Favor, and I used to call myself Rodney Yates Trail Flunky. And we just kind of... just joke about it. It was nothing that nobody disliked the series particularly. We just had, it was just kind of a way, and somebody picked up on it, I guess, is that it was a total unhappiness. It wasn't unhappiness. It was just kind of a way that, to keep yourself amused, I suppose. Eventually, when you do a series, after the years go by, you do start to get frustrated. You'd like to go on and do something else.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I'm no exception in that case.
Did you have any sense that your future was going to be in Westerns and in action films? Did you have a sense of that for yourself?
No, a lot of people thought, well, he's a tall guy, maybe he'd be good in Westerns. For some reason, somebody thinks that Western heroes are tall guys for some reason. That sort of based upon the predecessors of Gary Cooper, John Wayne, Randolph Scott and what have you over the years. But so they thought, well, maybe he'll play in Westerns or what have you. But nobody really knew. No, I was just kind of out there and hanging about, studying acting. And it was a steady job. It was kind of nice at the time.
Well, in some of your action roles, in some of your Westerns and like Dirty Harry films, you not only don't say a lot, but what you do say, you're saying often through clenched teeth, in that really guttural voice. How did you develop that style of speaking?
I don't know what you're talking about. Well, I think that the character just drives you in that. It's a character who is maybe frustrated with the things that the common person on the street are frustrated with, the bureaucracy that we live in, the nightmare that we as a civilization have placed on ourselves. I think this is a person who is frustrated with that, especially if you're trying to solve a case in a limited amount of time. So make my day line, or the do you feel lucky, punk, kind of lines were lines that people gravitated towards.
Did you have a sense of that reading the script that, you know, presidents would be, you know, making, you know, improvising on those lines, and that they'd be people just, they would just enter the general vocabulary? Could you read a script and say, these lines are going to last beyond the film?
Nobody can say that for sure, but you can kind of find the lines that are sort of squelch lines, the ones that come in and put a topper on it. I think the appeal of some of those early characters was the fact that the man would have the right answer, and it was always usually very terse and kind of right to the point, but with a little bit of humor involved, so that everybody said, God, I would love to be able to do that.
Have you ever been able to do that, have just the right comeback at just the right moment?
Very rarely.
Right. Now, when you're doing a line like "Make My Day," and you know, okay, this is a really good line, do you like go home and do line readings and go, "Make my day, make my day, make my day," and just do it over and over until you figure out exactly how you want to do it?
Looking into the bathroom right. mirror and doing some of your best acting.
Are you talking to me?
No, I don't. I don't go over the lines. I don't play them out loud. I'd rather play them for the first time when I do them.
No,
and
really?
I usually do them by the motivation of what the feelings are at the time. So I start them from what the intent is, and then let it kind of go out. It's sort of like a blowing through a trumpet or something. You start, and the sound magnifies as it comes out. If you sit there and practice line readings to yourself, you'll just get confused.
I want to get to your spaghetti westerns, the films you made with Sergio Leone. You started the Sergio Leone films when you were still making Rawhide, the TV western. How did Sergio Leone get to see Rawhide and decide you were the one to star in his western?
He had seen an episode that somebody had showing around, an agency had in Rome, and he had seen an episode, and they thought, well, here's a chance to hire an American actor who has been doing westerns but is not very expensive, and that they didn't have any
right.
they didn't have any money to spend, so they didn't have a lot of choices as far as names of the moment.
There's a lot of really interesting facial close-ups in your movies with Sergio Leone, and he had a very iconographic way of shooting faces, particularly your face. And your face in those close-ups is often, mysterious, unknowable. Instead of the facial close-ups like revealing this essence of who you are, they reveal the unknowability of who you are. And I've always wondered, what were you thinking during those close-ups to get the right expression on your face?
The first response would be to say absolutely nothing. To get the George Cukor used to say, he'd tell Greta Garbo sometimes to look into the camera and stare and don't think about a thing. But that's maybe a little oversimplification, or a way to get a certain effect out of her at that time. But you think about what you're doing with the plot line, what the demands are of the plot. Usually, because this character, though he wasn't saying a lot, he was plotting a lot, and so you just thought about what your next moves were. It's just a question of thinking like you would in regular in real life. You don't and you may be thinking. You have an inner monologue. Every actor plays an inner monologue as you're playing your outer character. And sometimes your outer character is saying, good evening, it's wonderful to see you. But underneath, you might be saying, yeah, dirty, rotten. So, you know, you really don't care. And so that's your inner monologue. And so I might have been saying something like that to myself at the time, is, you know,
you
I don't like these guys. I'd like to, you know, blow them all away, but I'd be very pleasant at the moment.
You developed a squint also in some of those close-ups.
Well, that was just the sunlight. And
was it?
Yeah. They bomb you with a bunch of lights, and you're outside, and it's 90 degrees. It's hard not to squint.
Richard Schickel, I want to ask you what you think of the importance of the Sergio Leone films in Clint Eastwood's filmmaking career.
Oh, I sort of think that Clint would have made his way into wider public consciousness in some other fashion, but I do also feel that those movies were so singular. They were truly, deeply, profoundly revisionist Westerns, as Clint has often said, at a time when the Western was in a kind of a dull place. The traditions of the Western in America had been kind of used up, and though we were in a period where Westerns were very popular in television and coming out of a period in which they had been very popular in the theaters. Nonetheless, you know, the basic Western moves, the traditional moves, had become dull and overused and kind of cliché-ridden. And I think it's one of the things that drew Clint to this was that opportunity, not just for his own character to expand a bit, but for him to participate in a kind of a revision of a form that he actually liked. I mean, it's important to remember that you know, Clint does know quite a bit about film history and so forth. He had seen Yojimbo, the Kurosawa movie, which was a source for this particular movie, for Fistful of Dollars, and he'd seen it 2 years before and had said, hey, this would make a great Western, but I don't think anybody in America will make it because it's too tough. And here were these crazy Italians who were, you know, willing to do exactly that.
Clint Eastwood, since there's been these great iconographic close-ups of your face, I'm wondering what you think of your face as a man, an actor, and as a director, because you've had to work with your face as a director and look at it very objectively, I'd imagine.
As a director, you think of yourself as another character. A lot of times when I'm talking to the editor, I'll say, when he comes in the room and she does this and hey, that goes here and what have you, I never think of myself in the first person. It's just you have to do that. And, you know, you don't dwell on your face. You dwell on the fact that you're there and the character. And if you think too much about certain things, you can get yourself very confused. So rather than do that, you just forge right on ahead with what you're doing.
Clint Eastwood and Richard Schickel speaking to Terry Gross. We'll be back with more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to more of Terry's interview with Clint Eastwood and Richard Schickel.
Now, in Richard Schickel's book about you, he says that you know, Rawhide followed the strict production code of the time. You couldn't show a fired gun and the victim of the bullet in the same shot. There had to be an edit in between. What was your reaction to Sergio Leone's really vivid approach to violence?
Well, that was true. The Hays office at that time had a rule for Westerns only, ironically, and you couldn't show the shootee and the shooter in the same shot. It couldn't be a tie-up shot, in other words. So you'd have to do it as an individual cut. And if you look at even later American Westerns of High Noon, you won't see the tie-up. But Sergio didn't know about all that, and I wasn't about to tell him because I was really enjoying this. It was breaking all, we were trying to break all the molds. And in breaking all the molds, it made those pictures a hit, or as somewhat of a revisionist idea, or certainly an outsider's point of view. They became popular, but they also brought with it some resentment, as you and Richard touched on earlier in the show. There was a lot of people who felt that who was this upstart? We didn't come in and bless this guy to come along, and we didn't bless these movies to come along, an Italian interpretation of the great American genre. So there was a certain resentment
that hung around with those pictures for some time. Now, as people look back on them, they enjoy the fact that there was a different this was a different period, and then it went on to somebody else. And Sam Peckinpah came along later, and he did another look at the Western. And someone else comes along and does another one. And I come back to him and take another shot. And somebody else down the line. That way, it keeps a great American art form alive.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting when you do look back at the Leone films is today, despite all of the hubbub about their violence, they're not terribly violent movies by modern standards. You know,
there's a lot of really sick, sadistic people in them.
That's true, and yet Leone, for the most part, does not linger. On the actual violence. He lingers on the lead up to violence. I mean,
the savoring kind of the violence.
There's a kind of a dance, an almost you know, sort of stately minuet leading up to the violence. I mean, the concluding shootouts and these things. It's a long and elegant time as people circle one another and in effect threaten one another. But the actual death is very quick. It's very clean. You know, we don't see a lot of blood squibs going off in the Peckinpah manner or slow motion death. Death is in these movies, as it so often is in life. I mean, it's quick, nasty, brutal, but it's not something that is in and of itself aestheticized. What's around it is aestheticized, but that the actual moment is not. It's shown for the brutal thing that it is.
Clint Eastwood, I thought that your choice of directing and starring in The Unforgiven was such an interesting choice, because it's a movie about a man who goes from bad man to good man to myth. And it's also interesting because it's about the difficulty of killing someone and what it takes out of you when you do kill someone. And you'd been in so many mythic movies and been in so many movies where the character that you played killed a lot of people. So I'm interested in how you related to the story in The Unforgiven and how it dealt with myth-making and with violence.
Well, those exact things that you mentioned are what attracted me to the project. The fact that but even though I had done pictures where I've been a police officer and Western films where I've had a lot of gunplay and stuff, it's not that I approved of that sort of thing. And I don't necessarily approve of the romanticizing of gunplay, and I don't think it's... And I thought here was a chance, here was a story that had... that sort of shot holes in that, if you'll pardon the pun. You know, it brought out the truth about gunplay and the fact that there is some loss to your soul when you commit an act of violence. And to play a person who was deeply affected in his life because of some of the mayhem that he'd been responsible for was to me made the character more interesting and was more interesting for me to play. In fact, I never thought the film would be really commercial when I was making it, because it had all these statements about mayhem and violence, and I thought maybe this might not be a straight-ahead action movie that people wanted, but I liked the story and I felt it was worth telling.
Well, Clint Eastwood, I feel like I must talk with you a little bit about music, and to kick off this chapter of our interview, let's listen to this.
Give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please. Don't fence me in.
Just turn me loose. Let me saddle my old saddle underneath the west.
Terry, you should have seen the pain in this room. Right?
And that's from the album Clint Eastwood Sings Cowboy Favorites. And there's a picture of Clint Eastwood as Rowdy Yates on the cover. Rawhide's Clint Eastwood singing.
That was I was the Milli Vanilli of the moment there. I did, that wasn't me.
Oh yes, it was. I actually like your singing voice. I really do. I mean, this is a strange album with strange arrangements and. Not always good songs, but I really like your singing, and I imagine you're also like influenced by Chet Baker in your singing. And...
Well, that wasn't first place. That wasn't the kind of songs that I would normally like to sing.
The songs on here, I'd imagine not. But you got to sing Cole Porter. Don't fence me in.
There's nothing wrong with that. Cole Porter is certainly wonderful. But what happened is that somebody had the brilliant idea that that I should do some cowboy songs, not country western songs. Nashville type, but real straight cowboy songs, and I wasn't sure whether I liked the idea, but they said, "Well, we'll do it, and we have a session tomorrow." And I said, "Well, not tomorrow, I'm leaving." "Well, will you do it? You just stop by the studio on the way to the airport." So I did a whole album. You think about people who take 6 months to make an album, but this one that we did the whole album in one session, and I didn't know the songs. I had to come in and learn them real quick and. Some of them I knew, some songs like that you've heard as a child, but you don't really know them. And so it was a little frustrating. It wasn't my favorite musical experience in life, but it was, there again, you learn something every day.
Now, had you sung much before? Did you think of yourself as a singer at all?
Not really. I'd done a few things. I'd done a few records. I'd been involved in music, so I could sometimes carry a tune. My father loved singing. He had a group that played, and he loved to sing all the time. He would love to have been a singer more than anything, I think.
Now, I know you're still, and were as a young man, very passionate about jazz. Did you ever think that you'd become a professional musician instead of an actor and director?
Well, I thought about that earlier when I was a kid and I was doing some things, but I never thought, I never really knew what I wanted to do until I became an actor. And at that point, I kind of knew which direction I was going to at least get up and swing at the bat.
Would you like to sing more or play more? Or?
No, I don't have any there's one of my key sayings.
Yes.
A man must know his limitations.
Clint Eastwood and Richard Schickel, speaking to Terry Gross in 1997. One of the films that made Eastwood a star, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, has just been released as a special edition DVD. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci, 7 Steps to Genius Every Day by Michael J. Gelb. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly continues. We'll hear more about the making of that great spaghetti western with actor Eli Wallach. He spent a total of 6 years making westerns in Italy. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Fahrenheit 9/11, the new documentary from Michael Moore.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Eli Wallach already had played villains in Westerns before he appeared opposite Clint Eastwood as Tuco, the ugly one in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. He was one of the toughest of the tough in the 1960 movie The Magnificent Seven. On stage, Wallach got his first big break as the star of the Tennessee Williams play, The Rose Tattoo. Williams also cast Wallach in his first film role, in a 1956 production of another Williams drama, Baby Doll. Wallach's other film credits include The Misfits, Movie Movie, and Godfather III. Terry spoke with Wallach in 1990. She asked him about his time at the Actors Studio in New York, where the actors practiced a technique that became known as the Method.
All of it basically was an antidote from the cliché, from the conventional. You know, when an actor says, "I remember," and he always looks up the sky, you think, what is he seeing up there? But that was a signal that he's remembering. And the method basically was to destroy all that and to get to the truth of a situation. So the studio was like a laboratory. We were professional actors in the theater, but we could go there and work out. I could go and do a scene from Hamlet with Millie Dunnick, for example. I'd do the closet scene. I wouldn't get to do that on Broadway. And I did it there.
Yet there were clichés about actors who'd studied the method at the Actors Studio, right? What was the cliché that you had to resist about actors from the Actors Studio?
Well, there's a myth that all members of the studio mumbled. All members of the studio paid no attention to the other person. They were so involved in dredging up the truth of what they had that they paid no attention to the other person. Those are myths. We were impossible. We discovered a new religion, and we had no patience for other actors. I never forget taking Sir Laurence Olivier to the Actors Studio, and he said, "Well, I can see you're nitpicking now, you know." And I said, "Well, you did it too. You have your way of working." Olivier, for example, gets into a character by putting on the externals. He puts on the nose and the robe and so on, and that's the way he gets it. Others say, which comes first? Do you find the truth of the situation? I've played all sorts of characters, bandits. I've played a lot of bandits. And one time I figured out, you always see them holding up the train or breaking into the bank. You never see what they do with the money. It's always the pursuit of it. I wanted to show the reverse side of the coin. I wanted to show the wealth this guy ostentatiously had. So I put on red silk shirts and gold teeth and silver saddles. And that's where the method helps, a kind of a technique that you work at to bring a character to life.
Was that The Magnificent Seven?
That was The Magnificent Seven, yeah.
Since you've brought up how many bandits you've played, let me bring up a couple of films you've played them in. One was The Magnificent Seven, and you played the head of a band of Mexican outlaws,
right,
who raids a village and keeps this village under the outlaws' control. And the Magnificent Seven is a group of kind of renegade freelance fighters who save this Mexican village. How'd you get cast in that role? First of all, you were
know.
Mexican.
And I don't really know. I know that when I first read the script, I said, well, I want to play the crazy... It was based on the Seven Samurai.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play the crazy samurai. Oh, no, they said, that's the love interest. Horst Buchholz is going to play it. What do you want me to play? They said, the head bandit. I said, well, in the Japanese movie, you just see his horse's hoofs, and he's a man with an eye patch. I don't want to play that. Then I read the script carefully, and I come in right into town on the first minute of that movie, shoot somebody, and ride out. The next 50 minutes of that movie are devoted to me saying, is he coming back? When is he coming? I said, I'll do it. And I used to arrive on the set early in the morning, put on my outfit, get on my horse with my 35 bandits, and we'd go for an hour ride through the brush in Tepoztlan in Mexico. And I loved it.
Did you have to learn gunplay and horse riding for the role?
No. If it says I shoot somebody, I shoot them. I'll never forget what my son said. Yul Brynner shot and killed me in this movie. And my son was about 7, and he said to me, gee, Dad, couldn't you outdraw Yul Brynner? I said, Peter, when you read the script, you read whether you're shot or not shot. So I love those kind of films. They're fun.
Now, another famous Western that you did is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Right.
Now, this is the most celebrated of the spaghetti Westerns.
Correct.
And the director, Sergio Leone, is now considered one of the great directors of our time. He was not known, though, when you worked with him on The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Did you think of him as a great or potentially great director then?
No, when I was making a film in California, when the agent out there said, there's an Italian here who wants you to be in a movie. I said, what kind of movie? He said, a Western. He said, a spaghetti Western. I said, that's an anomaly. That's like Hawaiian pizza. I don't know. He said, he wants you to look at a few minutes of one of his other movies. And I looked at a few minutes and I said, I'll do it. Where do you want me to go? He said, I want you in Rome on such and such a date. And I arrived. And I spent the next 4.5 months working every day on that movie. And it was an exhilarating experience.
Now, what had he seen of yours?
Evidently, The Magnificent Seven. So that, I don't know how, you never know how things happen in the movies.
Did it seem ironic to you that you and Clint Eastwood, who had played in American Westerns, were now making a Western for an Italian director?
Originally, all those Italians changed their names. Two of the biggest stars in Italy are Terence Hill and Bud Spencer. Their real names are Mario Girotti and Carlo Pedersoli. And they changed their names because no one wanted to go and see Italians playing Westerns. But I, after The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I spent about 6 years off and on in Italy doing Westerns.
Eli Wallach talking with Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with actor Eli Wallach.
You played a Mexican in The Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
Yep.
So once again, you had to do a Mexican accent, but it was a light one. It was kind of light,
yes.
Mexican accent. I want to play a short clip from the movie.
Oh.
Okay. And this is a scene. If anyone remembers the story, I'm sure a lot of our listeners do. You and Clint Eastwood have this scam going. There's a big price on your head.
Right.
So Clint Eastwood brings you into the law, and just as they're about to hang you, he cuts you loose, and you both ride away, and you split the bounty.
Exactly.
So you split the price that was on your head. So this is after the first time when you're about to be hung, Clint Eastwood frees you, and you're splitting up the bounty.
Right.
There are two kinds of people in the world, my friend. Those with a rope around their neck and the people who have the job of doing the cutting. Listen, the neck at the end of the rope is mine. I run the risks. So the next time I want more than half.
You may run the risks, my friend, but I do the cutting. We cut down my percentage. Cigar? Liable to interfere with my aim.
But if you miss, you had better miss very well. Whoever double crosses me and leaves me alive, he understands nothing about Tuco. Nothing.
I love that little sadistic laugh at the end.
But I don't think it's a very good Mexican accent. It's standardized. It isn't. I didn't do the cliche of I think maybe I do la third. You know, I don't. I didn't do that. I wanted specifically to be clear in what I was saying.
So where did you get the accent from?
I went to school in Texas as a young man. I went to the University of Texas in the 30s. In my class were John Connolly, Walter Cronkite, Zachary Scott, and Elaine Steinbeck. And I used to ride horses down there, and I used to go to Mexico as often as I could. I loved Mexico. I think Mexico is a pure country. It's a good country. And so I picked up. Accents always frighten me, but I once played an Oriental on the stage in London, Tea House of the August Moon, and I was convinced that at some point in the play, some Japanese man would stand up in the audience and point at me and say, "Faker, that man is not an Oriental." See? And I'd get terrified that I'd get discovered.
In the Italian westerns that you made, especially in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, everything's dubbed, right?
Right.
Afterwards?
Right.
So what language did you do it in initially?
Oh, I do it in English.
You do it in English.
But I've played with Italians, French, German. They play in their language. I play in mine.
So in these international casts, everybody's talking in their own language,
exactly.
And it's dubbed in afterwards.
It's the Tower of Babel. It really is. But you wait until they stop speaking, or you know what the sense of what they're saying. But then you have to go in a studio and dub it. And I kept thinking of scenes on horseback riding through the desert. Now I am in a studio. I have to match the essence of what he's saying. It's not easy.
Why do they do it that way?
Because it's easier and cheaper. An airplane flies over, they don't stop a scene. They drop a wrench in the middle of a scene. It makes a noise. They don't care. Two other Italians over in a corner will be arguing about something. One director said to an Italian actor who's playing with me, he said to me, the Italian actor said, "I don't like Americans." I said, "Why?" He said, "I lost my arm in the war." I said, "Well, I don't know. What could I do?" He was not an actor. So the director said, "I want you to count from 1 to 10 angrily." So the man said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then when they dub it in, he's playing a wonderful scene, an angry actor. Well, that's movies.
The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is really one of the most kind of brutal, sadistic westerns.
No, it's done with tongue in cheek.
I know. It is. I know there's a lot of humor in it. But what kind of mood did Leone, or Leone, I'm never sure which it is,
Leone,
tell you that he wanted?
One of the things he said to me, he said, "I want every shot to be done like Vermeer. I want the light to come in from the side windows." And he said to me, "I don't want you to have your gun in a holster." I said, "Where will I put it?" He said, "With a lanyard around your neck." I said, "Oh, and then it dangles between my knees, right?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "When you want it, you twist your shoulders, and I cut, and the gun is in your hand." I said, "Show me." He put it around his neck. He twisted his shoulder. He missed the gun. It hit him in the groin. He said, "Keep it in your pocket." So that's
It's interesting that you became a kind of action hero when you were probably in your 50s already.
When The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly?
And The Magnificent Seven.
Yeah.
You must have been younger. In your 40s in The Magnificent Seven. But, you know, like today, most action heroes are a lot younger. It's like they start off in their 20s and 30s playing that kind of role. Yeah. Did you feel like it was an odd match?
Well, you wear very tight pants in these movies, and to get up on a horse, they'd always have to cut. I'd put my foot in the stirrup, but then they'd cut away to somebody looking at me, and the next thing I was on the horse. See? So, no, I tell you, in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I did most of the stunts, and they were very dangerous. I was sitting on a horse with a noose around my neck, and Clint's supposed to shoot the rope, then they put a little charge of dynamite in the rope, and it would explode. And then I would ride off on this horse. I said, "Did you put any cotton in the horse's ears?" They said, "What do you mean, cotton in the horse's ears?" I said, "He can hear the explosion. He's going to be terrified. My hands are tied behind me." Well, they didn't do it. They shot the rope, and that horse took off. Now I'm riding, not using reins, just using my knees, and praying that that horse would eventually stop. And eventually he did. But it was frightening.
Oh, I'm really impressed because, I mean, that horse really takes off
after
the gun goes off.
Oh, yeah.
And I assumed there was some kind of trick there or something because I figured it would really need a stunt rider to ride with their hands tied behind their back.
No, I rode, but you have to be very careful. Horses are not, you know, I just came from Lexington, Kentucky in the horse country. We did the play down there. And horses are not supposed to be too smart. Thoroughbreds are very frisky. They're angry most of the time.
Yeah.
The horses I get in America, in American films, are trained. They know how to hit their marks. They shift their weight. They look great. But when you get into a foreign movie and they bring out a horse, I say, "I want the gentlest, sweetest horse." And he usually turns around and looks at me when I sit on him and thinks, "Oh, God, I've got this guy for 3 weeks." But I like riding.
Eli Wallach, speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. We're talking about Westerns today, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and the Funny. In honor of the 30th anniversary of Mel Brooks's Western farce Blazing Saddles, let's listen back to some of Terry's 1987 interview with Frankie Lane. He sang the theme. Lane had 21 gold records in the 50s and 60s, but many fans associate him with the Western tunes he made famous, including the themes from Gunfight at the OK Corral and this classic, Rawhide.
Keep rolling, 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 though the streams are swollen. Keep them doggies rolling, Rawhide. Through rain and wind and weather, hell-bent for leather, wishing my gal was by my side. All the things I'm missing, good victuals, love, and kissing, are waiting at the end of my ride. Move them out, hit them up, hit them up. Move them out, hit them up, Rawhide. Cut them out, ride them in, cut them out, ride them in, Rawhide.
When I spoke with Frankie Lane, I asked him how an Italian boy from Chicago wound up singing about gunfights and herding cattle.
In the beginning, I guess you might say that I was wondering what a city boy was doing singing country and Western songs and Wild West themes. But apparently, I guess I was like any other kid who watched the cowboys and Indians movies. I was crazy about Westerns. And maybe it all harks back to that. I really don't know, but it all seemed to come naturally, and I didn't seem to have any trouble adjusting to that genre of music. And yet I never sounded exactly like a country singer in the sense of a Jim Reeves or any of those guys.
You know, I remember whenever I used to see you on the Ed Sullivan Show, I used to always hope that you'd sing Rawhide. And the times I saw you, you never did. So I guess I wonder if you've ever included that as part of your repertoire and performances.
Well, part of the deal on Rawhide entailed the proviso that I had to record the song first and that it had to be out at least 8 weeks prior to the TV show going on the air, which it was. And I was glad because by the time the TV show did debut, the record was a smash and it was fighting for the number one spot. In fact, the producers themselves told me later that the theme song, the popularity of the Rawhide record, kept the TV show on the air for about 4 months, and everybody laughs when I tell them that. And then I say the TV show caught on and kept me on the air for 7.5 years, so it turned out to be good for both of us.
Did you enjoy the opportunity of doing a send-up of all of your Western themes when Mel Brooks asked you to do Blazing Saddles, the theme from his Western spoof, Blazing Saddles?
I have to confess, Terry, that I was a complete dummy about that whole situation. I was working Vegas at the time, and I happened to do a Merv Griffin guest shot. Now, I get a call only about 20 minutes after the show went off the air from Mel Brooks, and I thought it was a gag. And I didn't know too much about Mel Brooks at that time. And he said, "I'm Mel Brooks, and I'm producing a picture called Blazing Saddles, and we have a theme song that we would like for you to do." And nobody told me that this picture was a comedy or a takeoff. I did it absolutely dead, sure, certain, serious. And then I was stunned when I saw the preview of the movie, and I almost died when I realized that I was part of a big comedy setup. And I got ribbed about it an awful lot. But he said later, he says, "That's why we didn't tell you." He says, "We wanted you to do it dead serious."
Blazing saddle, he wore a shining star. His job to offer battle to bad men near and far. He conquered fear and he conquered hate. He turned dark night into day. He made his blazing saddle a torch to light the way.
Frankie Lane singing the theme from Blazing Saddles. Coming up, Fahrenheit 9/11. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Michael Moore's provocative new documentary, Fahrenheit 9/11, opens around the country today. Finally, the public gets a chance to see the film that's caused so much fuss and gotten so much advance press. Disney backed out of distributing it. It won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival. And most recently, some conservatives have argued that if commercials for the film featuring President Bush continue after July 31st, the 30-day mark before the Republican National Convention, it'll constitute a violation of campaign finance law. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Remember the 80s? Reagan and Bush in office, Jimmy Carter off building houses for the poor, Mondale and Dukakis ineffectual Democratic candidates. There were right-wing dirty tricksters like Lee Atwater, then bullying TV and radio personalities like Morton Downey Jr. and the fledgling Rush Limbaugh. Back in that era, a lot of liberals found themselves wishing for a blowhard whom the left could call its own, someone who'd give it right back, who'd recapture the prankster spirit of counterculture leaders like Abby Hoffman, who'd muck and spew and savage instead of taking it like a wussy. So now we got him, Michael Moore, whose Fahrenheit 9/11 is the liberals' The Passion of the Christ, a barnstorming and cathartic declaration of holy war against George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and the rest of the president's men. On one hand, it's a compelling polemic. On the other, a piece of thuggish grandstanding with wall-to-wall cheap shots. I don't trust anyone, pro or con, who doesn't feel at least a little ambivalence about his or her responses to this film. Needless to say, the film itself never waffles. Here are more salient points: that Bush and his family have been in bed with the Saudis, which made him less responsive to the likelihood of Al-Qaeda terrorism, especially since a pipeline in Afghanistan promised billions if the Taliban was on board. Better to concentrate on Iraq, unfinished business, and a potential gold mine for U.S. corporations. Moore ranges far and wide. He shows graphic footage of dead Iraqi children killed in what the Pentagon called surgically precise bombings, and a grieving old woman shrieking curses at Americans. On the home front, Moore implies that the Patriot Act was unread by legislators and harps on absurd applications like the agent who infiltrated a septuagenarian cookie-baking peace collective in Fresno. In the last act, Moore dogs hawkish congressmen outside the Capitol. Would they send their own sons and daughters to fight in Iraq, he asks, often to their backs as they flee. It's true that you can make anyone look like a goofball with a careful selection of unflattering shots and out-of-context quotations. But Moore has an easy time finding clips that make the president look bad.
With everything going wrong, he did what any of us would do. He went on vacation.
We must stop the terror. I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
That's the Moore technique. Ironic music, jokey stock shots of American leisure, and Bush hanging himself. Now, you might see an honest, plain-spoken leader unfairly ridiculed, in which case I doubt you'll be a convert. But Fahrenheit 9/11 will put fire into the troops and maybe sway the undecided with powerful images, like the shot of Bush in the Florida elementary school classroom after receiving the news that a second plane has hit the World Trade Center. 7 minutes in which the commander-in-chief seems kind of superfluous. Moore is best when he doesn't stage dumb pranks, but provokes with his mere presence. When he interviews the author of House of Bush, House of Saud in front of the Saudi embassy, and the Secret Service shows up to ask what he's doing, it's a gotcha moment. He has a light touch there that's missing from the rest of Fahrenheit 9/11. In one scene, his camera moves in like a vampire on a Flint, Michigan woman weeping over a son killed in Iraq. Afterwards, a friend railed that Moore was exploiting a mother's grief. When I suggested that at least it made moral sense in the director's universe, my friend said, "When did you become a relativist?" I'm troubled by that charge and by the fact that we almost came to blows. But I think that when it comes to politics, relativism is, well, relative. This is not a documentary for the ages. It is an act of counter-propaganda that has a boorish, bullying force. Like it or hate it, you'll be spoiling for a fight.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From TIAA CREF, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org. By Nonesuch Records, featuring A Ghost Is Born, the new album by Wilco, available at all Barnes & Noble music locations. And from Endless Pools, a treadmill for swimmers, allowing people to swim at home, year-round, indoors or outside. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS. That's 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, singer Bobby Short. He's been playing piano and singing at the Carlyle Hotel in New York City for 36 years. He's considered one of the great cabaret singers of our time. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
You've got that thing, you've got that thing, the thing that makes birds forget to sing. Yes, you've got that thing, that